That was so much fun. We're going to stay with her for the rest of the week. Much fun. She's back. We're handing over to Satanique.
Thank you. On to agenda paper 5. The committee received a submission about a sale and leaseback transaction with variable payments. The submitter asks how the seller lessee measures the right of use asset arising from the leaseback and thus determines any gain or loss recognized at the date of the transaction. We conducted outreach on this matter. Paragraphs 10 to 19 summarize our findings. Based on our analysis in paragraphs 20 to 45, we conclude that at the date of the transaction, an entity measures the right of use asset arising from the leaseback at the proportion of the previous carrying amount of the asset that relates to the right of use retained by the seller lessee, and accordingly recognizes only the amount of any gain or loss that relates to the rights transferred to the buyer lessor. I would like to draw your attention to question 1 on page 15 and ask if you agree with our analysis of the requirements in IFRS standards.
Okay, so the technical analysis first, and very, very focused and specific question that was asked. Carl.
I agree with staff's analysis. I would suggest, especially paragraph 29 of the paper, provides a lot of clarity. I would transfer somehow additional words from this paragraph to the agenda, to the tentative agenda decision. I think it would be quite helpful.
Most of the staff's analysis, but not all of it. In the staff's analysis and in the proposed agenda decision, the staff talks about calculating the proportion using the value of the right of use versus the value of the asset. And I think that's one way to do it, but I don't think that's the only way to do it. In paragraph 100 of 16, it talks about you calculate the proportion, but it doesn't say how. And so I think in certain circumstances, time can be a basis for calculating the proportion. So, for example, it's got a 10-year economic life, but I'm leasing it back for 6 years. I think I could do, 60%, calculate that as 60% retained. I don't think the standard actually precludes that. So I think the agenda but the agenda decision doesn't recognize that. The other aspect is I think this tentative agenda proposed agenda decision raises additional questions that I'd love to head off before we were to actually publish something. For example, how do I deal with renewal options? Now, one way to think about it is, well, if a renewal option is reasonably certain, well, then you include it. If it's not, you don't. I actually think another view is better, and that you always include renewal options because you could look at them as mini repurchase options, right? I can repurchase additional pieces of this asset that I sold, and so that I would always include the renewal. So I think there's these two potential that I think we should analyze. The other question I think this raises is when you do the journal entries, as the staff demonstrates in the agenda paper, it comes up with a liability. I think we need to give people a little more guidance on that liability. You know, is it in the scope of 9? Is it in the scope of 16? Do you have a choice? Is it a judgment? What do I base the judgment on? So I think there's some – what I would like to see is the staff take it back and deal with some of these other additional issues that the – this raises before we were to issue an agenda decision.
Do you want to comment on at least those first two?
Yeah. Bob, I just wanted to comment on your first point, and I mainly want to comment on to explain our thinking and putting the paper together and to explain so that
There is a slight difference, I think, in how we viewed it. So to the extent other people agree with you and not with us, I think it's important to make it clear. So I think when we sort of analysed what 100A is saying about measuring the right of use asset at the proportion of the previous carrying amount, our view there is that the way we read that is to say that needs to be based on value of the right of use. Because you're trying to work out the proportion of the overall asset that relates to the right of use, that is based on value of the right of use versus value of the whole underlying asset. Now, I think then mechanically the way that you might often be able to do that is potentially in your way. So to the extent that, for example, there's an economic life of 10 years and the leaseback period is 6 years, and the, you know, that using, you know, 6 compared to 10 years is a kind of, it would result in sort of an appropriate sort of proxy to get to what's the value of my right of use retained, you know, compared to the overall asset, then we would think it's an appropriate methodology. But I suppose our thinking is that the words tell you to do value versus value, but then it doesn't specify an exact way that you would work out value versus value, and time could be used as one of the ways to do that.
Do you agree with that observation? That's sort of the objective of the measurement, so you could get there in different
ways.
I accept that,
and I can vote for that. I struggle because I don't see the word, the value in 100. But again, you know, if we're connecting dots, I could get behind.
Okay. Bob?
Oh, sorry.
Gary? Guy, even. It's already been a long day.
There were two T's in there. I'm not sure where the B came from. I understand the perspective taken in the paper about paragraph 100A. Saying, you know, how I'm measuring my right of use that I've retained and was inherent in my original carrying value. I understand the perspective that, you know, I'm not measuring that right of use retained based on paragraph 24 of IFRS 16 because it's based on the carrying value of my previous asset and not necessarily the economics of the leaseback. And I understand that IFRS 16 is silent in terms of prescribing a method to measure, you know, that proportionate amount that I've retained, the value I've retained versus the value I've transferred. So I understand all of that. However, the point of pause I'm having is I find it difficult to say all of that, but then not address precisely what the credit is in the resulting entry that results from that. And, you know, I'd like to be able to think, well, okay, you know, we don't need to do that. We can leave that, you know, for, you know, others to sort of assess what they think that is in their facts and circumstances. But I'm struggling to disconnect that issue from the initial entry. Because I have to record all the components of that entry, and all the components of that entry have to comply with some standard. And I'm creating a liability in that initial entry, and the measurement of that liability has to comply with some standard, because I have to apply a standard to it, you know, immediately thereafter. And so in that initial entry, I need to define what that liability is. Is that an IFRS 9 liability? Is that an IFRS 16 liability? And is the way I've determined the proportion of the value retained, which is what that credit amount is going to be in that initial entry, consistent with the measurement requirements of whatever standard I'm going to apply to that liability? So I need to be able to say what that liability is in my initial entry, because it could influence how I measure the proportion of the value I'm retaining. And then it also has, you know, day two consequences in terms of, you know, what standard applies to that liability in terms of subsequent measurement, where the remeasurements of that would go, when I would remeasure, et cetera. And so My reaction to the paper is it kind of stops short of that last question, but that last question to me is inherent in the initial journal entry I'm defining in this paper. And so that's similar to, I think, what Bob was saying. The analysis just seems to stop a bit short, and there's another aspect to that initial journal entry that I need to address some way, somehow.
Maybe can I make a comment on that, looking at the staff recommendation in case it's wrong, but I think I partly and largely perhaps agree with some of the comments that you've made, because I think there is an important sort of day two question, which is what both you and Bob have raised, which is what do I then do with this credit entry? But I guess, and the reason why I said in my sort of initial comments was we've been asked an interestingly specific question, because I almost feel like we were asked a question that was designed to get us to talk about the day one entry and not to look at the day two entry. I'm not sure if that was the case or not, but for me, I couldn't come up with a different credit entry that was compliant with the paragraph, these specific paragraphs in IFRS 16, which is why, in a sense, I felt comfortable with the analysis when I read this paper in terms of what the entries would be to answer the specific question asked. I think there is a very good day two question then about what the heck do I do going onwards in terms of what the location for the accounting for that liability is. But I don't think I could start with for this actual sort of derecognition type contract transaction, or at least the sale and leaseback initial transaction. Would you agree that the debits and credits have to be the way that they're set out in this paper, because otherwise I'm not compliant with those very specific requirements in 16? And then there is another question, which is how do I then account going forwards for that liability?
Yeah. So the
that's a genuine question. I mean,
yeah, I appreciate that question. And I was, you know, originally thinking in my own mind that, yeah, I could compartmentalize this question and say there's a day one entry, and then there's a separate question about what I do with the credit day two. But I'm struggling with that the more I reflect on it, because when I book that initial entry, I'm booking a liability, mm-hmm. and I have to be able to say I've measured the liability properly in that initial entry, and to say it's sort of the residual that falls out of the calculation in 100A is you know, I can say that, but is that really compliant with the standard that applies to that liability?
Yeah, and I think that is a good day two question, but the thing that made me, you know, and others can have a view, but just to put it out there, made me comfortable with the day one entry is clearly the board had thought super hard about what they thought the depiction of that sale and leaseback transaction should be and the logic around how you would calculate the amount of the gain or loss. There's been a lot of thought and effort that's gone into that entry, so it was very focused on that particular outcome, which necessitates a particular amount being recognised for the liability. I agree with you, there probably should have been a bit of more focus perhaps on what the day two accounting then was, mm-hmm. but I was pretty confident with the entry that's shown to answer the very specific question in the paper, because it so lines up with all of the logic and the basis and the thinking and the example that we've already got as an IE that was issued as part of the standard. So that's what gave me the comfort that I agree with you, it's a sort of an odd approach where the liability is like a plug number, but it's not inconsistent with other parts of our literature. So, for example, say you were in the hideous continuing involvement accounting that we've got in our FI literature, which is very much a construct to deal with a sort of similar thing where you've got an unusual fact pattern. You end up with unusual amounts there because you're trying to focus on a particular outcome on the day the initial transaction is achieved, which is also inconsistent with other logic you might otherwise use, but it's because it's a special fact pattern. I agree with you, it may be relevant to say, okay, but we need to say something about day two, but just for day one, I felt like that the amount of the gain or loss that we end up with was sort of in the spirit of what the board had been talking about.
So I don't disagree with you that there's a lot of day two aspects to this, but I'm not sure it all is day two, because if I had to produce financial statements at the exact same time I book this entry, I still have to think about whether, you know, now in my balance sheet, do I present this as a financial liability, to present this as a lease liability?
I'm not saying it's not 5 minutes after, but my only point I'm trying to distinguish, I think, is I'm pretty confident that the amount of gain or loss that I end up on is the correct number given the logic in 16.
And I suppose I would just add, and I think you said this, Guy, so I'm just picking up on it, is that even though you could say that maybe the liability number falls out of how clear the requirements are about measuring the asset and the gain, it actually does represent something, because I think to the point you said, it actually represents what is the seller lessee's obligation in relation to the leaseback. So it is, you know, a real liability, and it is it does represent an obligation.
Yeah. So I could see someone saying, well, what that liability is an obligation to pay back part of the sale proceeds I received. You know, I'm not really accounting for the leaseback per se, given all the guidance in 100A, and you know, does that then draw me to the conclusion that liability is an IFRS 9 liability rather than an IFRS 16 liability? Maybe, but there is a leaseback there, and so I could see someone else being drawn to, well, no, I really think this is an IFRS 16 liability because it relates to a leaseback, and then I'm kind of lost as to how I'm to measure that and whether that day one measurement really fits into IFRS 16 or, you know, how do I...
For me, I think if we want to cover that, we should bring the paper back with that analysis because...
I think the point that Sue and I are making, at least for us, we agree there is a day two question there, but at least I don't see that the day two question could in any way affect the day one credit that is liability. Just in the same way, I think, so as Sue described a situation in IFRS 9, I will describe in a different sort of like business combination accounting or something. You've got requirements that tell you exactly what to do on day one for sale and leaseback. So in my case, I think you've got requirements that tell you exactly what to do on day one. I don't see that the day two question would influence my day one in any way.
It might even be a day one and 30-second question. Yeah. Because I think maybe what we have here is a situation where 16 tells us, I think, what the gain or loss is that you have to recognise on this actual sale and leaseback transaction. You may weirdly, for some reason, I don't think it's the case, but in theory you could end up with an immediate adjustment to the liability because of where its home was. But I think that would be another journal that was to do with the remeasurement of the liability as opposed to questioning the gain or loss.
Yeah. It could have the effect of completely unwinding the day one entry. I'm not trying to suggest this is the right perspective, but you know, if someone said, okay, I'll book that day one entry, but that liability I just set up is an IFRS 16 liability, and so day two I immediately have to reverse the variable payment component.
No.
I'm not suggesting
that's right.
There's nothing in the subsequent measurement requirements in IFRS 16 that would tell you to do that.
If I may, just on that
point. You're responding specifically?
Point, yeah, and then I'll leave it be. But I think IFRS 16 paragraph 100A gives you the calculation of the number. It doesn't tell you what it is. And to me, that is relevant to the entry on the point. So I do think that it is relevant to the entry on before you get to day two. Because I think you have a number, but you don't know what the nature is. So that I think, is the question.
Just slightly different how I would have read it. I would have read it as saying this is a number which is because of your gain or loss on doing the sale and leaseback transaction, step one. But very quickly, the next question is, what do I now do with that liability?
But I think it's more than that, because when you have a number, what account does it go to?
I thought that all the chat and the basis about the idea behind these paragraphs made it clear that the board was thinking of that as being the sort of gain or loss on the leaseback. But anyway, that's what others have to say. Jim?
I agree with the staff analysis and the logic. As Sue mentioned, it follows the existing principles to the answer. But I'm just, as a guy raised, it is a day one question because so we just talk about the financial liability, so-called, on page 13. I think this example is perfect to show the problem here. Just the nature of this financial liability, the 450K, on the appearance, it has two components in it. Mm-hmm. One, this is 200 sort of deferred gain because you have a million assets, you sold it for $1.8 million. You recognize 600, so this 200K should be somehow deferred. 10 years down the road, all the concerns and contracts are cleared, you will recognize this 200. And the 250 is the equivalent to the ROU assets. So ideally, we should call it on the debit side, we have the ROU asset. On the credit side, we should have a lease liability. But we can't. It's not fit into the lease liability definition. So I think we walked into a kind of a dilemma here. So just to, on day one, should we call it the financial liability, or should we recognize the two components and show them differently? One line is deferred gain. What should we call the other, the 250? We call it lease liabilities, some sort, or lease liability on seller lessee recognition. It's a special treatment, not exactly fit into the definition of lease liability, because it's variable or based on the previous assumptions. It shouldn't be called a lease liability if it's not a seller lease back situation. So I think following the logic, we end up with a perfect answer, but this answer is kind of a trap to show that how should we define a lease liability under the consideration of lease, seller lease back, the 100A term. So I think as long as we're clear, this is a special treatment, we should recognize a lease liability under this condition, I'm fine. We recognize two components within the line financial liability, and we will have the day two treatment. On the deferred gain, we kind of allocate through the usage or some other method on the lease liability, so-called lease liability. As a result of the ROU assets, we deal them according to the 16th. So I think we somehow we have two components buried under this line financial liability. Whether or how should we recognize this, the differences between the two factors is the dilemma.
Mary?
Do you want Bertrand?
Sorry. You had your card up first, didn't you?
I worry that I'm going to be unintentionally provocative, but I was never good at subtle. When Bob first raised the question of their day two, day two issues, I was thinking, Bob, come on, mission focus, no scope creep. But then as I thought more about his question, I realized that in some ways it was bringing up what is view A in the, in the original submission, because the view A said, well, we've got general requirements for the measurement of a lease liability, and the day two issue is that the measurement of the lease liability that result, that's shown in the journal doesn't necessarily match up when you have these wholly variable payments with what you would do if it were a brand new right of use that you were acquiring. And I think the staff analysis makes very clear that the board, when it was finalizing 16, said stickiness matters. Mm-hmm. And if it was yours, we have a special section that says you this is what you do in terms of measuring the ROU. It
and the gain or loss.
Right. I was going to say that. So view A, which said the general requirements for measuring ROU trump the sale leaseback, you have eviscerated, because you have explained what the board's intention. I think this is back to Carl's point about what was the paragraph 22 being very clear that the board said in these circumstances we are setting aside the normal measurements of the ROU and having very specific guidance on how you do it, and that the standard itself comments explicitly about both the gain and loss and the measurement of the ROU. and I didn't know if you guys were being subtle and delicate, as is your style, of course, Bob, to say, should we still consider view A limited only to the measurement of the liability, in effect? And I guess whether you do it as part of the original entry or you do it as the day two remeasurement of the liability is in effect the consequence of the question you're asking. Is there any validity in view A applying only to the measurement of the liability, or do you have to consider that liability separately? Yeah. I wouldn't have thought so, even though the language in 100A
Given how explicit 100A is.
Right. But I wanted to draw it. It's not just a day two. Can't we go a little further and be a bit more helpful? Thinking about that day two issue could be read by some as raising questions about...
Which was why I was...
Trying to be fierce in a subtle way?
I was trying to be sort of direct, but maybe in a more subtle way than others, but...
only me.
Because I would have thought that to comply with paragraph 100A, it's sort of, to me, indisputable that there has to be a credit for the gain amount that we've got in our journal entry here. So even if you thought a minute later you had to do another entry to do something with the financial liability, and I don't know whether you do or not, but let's say for argument's sake you did, I would say you wouldn't be allowed to book it as an adjustment to the gain or loss because 100A is so explicit.
Yeah.
That's what's my logic, but maybe others disagree. Bob, do you want to respond on that specifically?
Yes, I do. So putting aside the scope creep, the day two issues, I do think there still is the day one that we could explain, because I do agree with the how you calculate under 100A and you come up with this right of use asset in this game, but then you were left with this credit. Well, what does that day one, what does that credit represent? And does that cause me to conflict with other parts of the standard? Because now when I recognize the variable lease payments, part of it's going to have to go against this credit that's on the balance sheet, which now that, well, because 16 tells me, well, when I make variable lease payments, they have to go all into the income statement. And so now I'm putting part of that variable lease payment against this liability, because I think what we're saying is you're paying back part of this price, and that's what we're recognizing this liability. But we don't really explain that.
So can I come in, hopefully, and at least answer a couple of your points, Bob? So I think it's a very good, by the way, we are at least, first of all, talking about day one, and I think if we look at the journal
entry. Even just day one, the initial entry.
Yes, sorry, that's what I mean. So the initial entry and therefore all of the journals in paragraph 40 of the paper. And so as we say, we think 100A is crystal clear about how you measure the asset, is crystal clear about what the gain is. That means consequentially there is a credit, and to us that's absolutely credit liability. That's not an item of income or expense, that's not equity, it's liability. And also I think to the point is, and if it's helpful, we can describe what that liability is, and we could do that because the description of what the liability is it actually represents the seller's lessee's obligation to the buyer lessor in relation to the lease back.
Yeah.
Now, what I just said is, I think, is true. That's neutral. It doesn't tell you that whether day two is that you go into 16 or go into 9, but it is the seller lessee's obligation to the buyer lessor in relation to the leaseback. That's what it is. So hopefully it's not just that this falls out. It actually represents something. I think just in concerns, the Bob, if you had a concern that if you went into 16 on day two, what would happen, at least the wording in 16 about what are normally variable payments is that it talks about variable payments not included in the measurement of the liability. So I think any wording in 16 that talks about when those payments flow to P&L, it's worded as the variable payments that are not included in the measurement of the liability. So hopefully there isn't a contradiction there.
Young Soo.
I have two comments. The first comment is about the financial liability in the example. In the example, financial liability is for $450. And to me, it was not that difficult at all. $450 was just one-fourth of $1,800, which is the one-fourth of the fair market value of the asset. So what that means is that one-fourth of the fair market value has not been transferred to the lessor and still maintained by the lessee. So still, the $450 are retained guide the lessee, that is a kind of liability mm-hmm. that should be paid to the lessor as a part of the fair value. So that's what I have been interpreted. But as for the second day accounting, I have a lot of curiosity about that. Yeah, because of that, you know, as Bob said, this agenda paper doesn't seem to be complete. So that is the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is also the same as what Bob said. There are a lot of other ways to calculate the proportion. Bob said just one thing, using the useful life. And I can say another method, like if we know the fair value of the asset and if we know the residual value of the asset at the end of the lease term, we can just by using those two and can calculate the value mm-hmm. of the asset retained by the lessee. I mean, by just subtracting the residual value from the total fair value, we can find out how much value of the asset is retained by the lessee. So there could be many other ways. Having said that, I think the last sentence of the first paragraph of page 18 in the agenda decision seems to be unnecessary. The last sentence of the first paragraph of page 18 says, the seller lessee could determine the value of that value. For example, at the present value of expected lease back payment, including those that are variable at market rates. And what I'm thinking is that this sentence can unnecessarily draw the attention of the readers to the liability side. I mean, maybe by just reading it, the readers might think that they must determine the liability before they determine the ROU asset. So I don't think that is a kind of unnecessary attention we can draw. So maybe the first sentiment, the sentence just before that, is more than enough. It just says that there are many other ways to determine the ROU assets. So I suggest to delete this sentence from the agenda decision.
I'm guessing, because I haven't had this conversation with the staff, but I suspect the reason why they've suggested including that sentence is that this is probably why we got the question.
Sure, question, yes.
Because people are trying to make sure that they're asking the committee to confirm that even though usually you wouldn't end up with a liability in this situation because of the extreme fact pattern, do we really think that because of these specific requirements in 16 that you do in this case in order to get this gain amount calculation to work, which is why you've...
Yeah. Yep. We tried to clear certainly that's just a for example to not say this is always the way it has to be.
But yeah, I understand that. But, yeah.
Bertrand?
I agree with the staff analysis. On this question of the financial liability, I like Patrina's proposal. I mean, for me, when I read the paper, I thought, yes, the financial liability is obviously a lease liability. And it falls within IFRS 16. I heard many commenting on that, saying, is it IS 32, IFRS 9, or IFRS 16? I mean, to be very honest, it has not a great interest, and I think it might be useful effectively in the tentative agenda decision to explain why it should be a lease liability. I perfectly acknowledge the fact that you have a core principle in IFRS 16 stating that for true variable payments, you do not compute them within the lease liability. But you might have also exception to a core principle, which would be there the case within a sale and lease back transaction, and then you would effectively compute a lease liability, even though those are variable payments, when you are in the context of a sale and lease back transaction, because what prevails is sale and lease back accounting and not the mere principle of variable payments accounting within IFRS 16. So I think really I was quite surprised by those questions, and I think what Patrina proposed is an easy way to answer those questions. Just a joke, but for those who have already tried to learn French, you know that the grammar is such that there is the the principle, then the exception to the principle, then the exception to the exception to the principle, then and so on and so forth. So honestly, you can totally appreciate that within a principle-based standard, you have a principle and an exception to the principle. The other thing, you're using market rates. So I totally appreciate that the staff intended using those words in the agenda paper or in the tentative agenda decision to mean market conditions, at market conditions, let's put it that way. But when I read the paper and the agenda decision, I was wondering whether market rate could have meant market discount rates, which would have been probably a difficulty there. Then probably if you really mean market conditions, then use something else than rates, because so that there is no ambiguity that it's not discount rates you're meaning.
Thanks, Petra. Carsten?
Yeah, I agree with what most people have said. I think there's a perhaps a disconnect between, what people are thinking in terms of the day one versus day two accounting, right, in terms of what we're looking at, whether we are looking at the, remeasurement of the liability or the right of use asset versus something affecting the gain on the transfer. Personally, I don't think any subsequent, day two accounting would affect the day gain from the sell and lease back, but it may affect, other parts, of the journal entry. So therefore, I think it is possible to address the day one accounting without addressing the day two accounting. However, I think we should probably still address the day two accounting, even though I don't think it would affect the gain, right? It would affect, it may affect other numbers. Maybe two additional observations. I was wondering a little bit, I don't think view A is appropriate because that leads to recognizing a gain, the full gain up front. And I think IFRS 16 clearly tells you that you don't do that, right? But I was wondering whether there might be, kind of a modified view or a third view, right, where you still end up with not recognizing all of the gain. And that touches upon the day two measurement questions, I think, in terms of how do you measure the liability, how do you measure the asset. So I think it's worth exploring that. The final comment I would make is in terms of the measurement of that liability, in this example, I think the measurement is would be consistent with IFRS 9 because it is based on expected future cash outflows. However, I would probably note that that may not always be the case, right? I mean, we talked about earlier that different measurement methods may apply. It's a residual amount, so you could end up with some sort of liability that is not consistent with initial IFRS 9 measurement, and I think that's also worth taking that into consideration when thinking about the day two accounting.
Bonnie?
I think we need, in order to address the day one accounting, we need to address what the nature of the liability is. So I think the paper needs to address that because I've heard three different examples. One is it's a lease liability, which I don't think is clear. One is it's a combination, which could be the case, or it's implicitly a loan, some sort of financing arrangement. And the accounting for each of those, day two, is different, which I understand is day two, but I think as I think about as a preparer, what account do I put these things in? I have no idea what that is. So do I look at the substance of the arrangement and the economics, which could give me an indication of what it is? Clearly plausible, not addressed in IFRS 16. Or is there something else that I refer to?
I mean, just sorry, Catherine.
I was going to say, is it okay if I ask a question? I'm asking a response to you, but it's probably relevant to a number of the comments that have been made. With regard to the day two question, I kind of just want to make sure that I understand what it is that's being raised, in the sense that in the sale and leaseback requirements and associated examples and such,
the standard is consistent throughout in referring to it as a financial liability. So we have an example that literally uses exactly those same words that I used in the paper. And if I'm understanding the day two challenge that is being raised correctly, I don't think it's specific to the question that was asked, in the sense that question about where would you categorise that financial liability, I think would apply to any sale and leaseback transaction, if I'm understanding it. And I guess, given that there are a lot of sale and leasebacks, I just wonder if the issue that the members are raising is specific to this fact pattern, or...
It may not be specific, but if I report kind of right after day one, what disclosure do I put that liability in? Is it a provision? Is it a financing? Where do I put it on the cash flow statement? What do I do with it? What is it? What is the nature of it? That's the issue that I have. It's a practical application of, I know the number, very clear the number. What is it?
So it is the case that question arises with every sale and leaseback transaction?
Me, it does.
To make sure,
and I guess that's the question, is it dependent on what the sale leaseback is doing, in which case that gives me an indication of the overall economics as to what it is, or is it clear that it is a lease liability, full stop, done, or is it a combination of things?
Mm-hmm. Well,
That I think is what I'm struggling with.
For me, it comes down to how you read the scope paragraphs in IFRS 9. So you've got a contractual obligation to pay cash to the buyer, mm-hmm. to use a neutral term.
And that is what the liability yeah. represents. So as a neutral term, it's an obligation.
You've got a contractual obligation to pay an amount to the buyer, which means that in the first instance it meets the definition of a financial instrument. Yeah. So in the first instance, it comes into the scope of 9, which scopes in all financial instruments, accepts rights and obligations under leases to which 16 applies. So then you've got to decide whether it's a liability to which 16 applies, and that then gives you the answer of where its home is, which is an answer...
That, I think, has to be fully addressed.
Which is an answer which is relevant to all leasebacks. It's just because this is such a disconnect with the usual a measurement in 16 that people are focused on it more.
Yeah.
And if we think that's clear in the guidance, then I think that needs to be added to the paper.
Bruce?
Thanks, Sue. To start off with, I agree with the staff's position in terms of where they got to. I actually don't think I'd appreciated your comment on the liability until you articulated it like that, but I actually think it's a very valid point when you start asking about what it is. So my suggestion was going to be, I'd support Bonnie that I'd definitely put that in. Something, just tell him, I appreciate we may get there, but let's just put it in to make it clear. I guess the only thing I just was going to comment on is kind of the argument, just my overall comment on the paper is I found I kind of had to work through these journals to really, in my mind, get to where what we were talking about. And I guess my only concern is when you get to the agenda decision, I don't think we've really articulated the thinking that's come through in the journals. Now, I know we always loathe to put example journals into these agenda decisions, but this is one of those where I just felt that until I'd kind of worked through the numbered example and saw where that credit spat out, I was like, okay, now I see the problem. We've got a liability arising here that intuitively, when you read the question, you say to yourself, we shouldn't have anything. So I know we normally don't like to put too many journals in, but to me this is just where, if we're not going to put the journal, some way to articulate exactly and maybe a bit clearer to me how that liability arose, so that people can understand that, you know, we can have a liability even if you've got these variable payments. And to me, it's just we could have made that a bit clearer.
It's aligned with the suggestion of the paragraph 29 of the papers.
Mm. Yeah.
Could be a solution.
Michael?
So I thought what Catherine said just now was really helpful, because I think what you're saying is that whatever the day two accounting is, and I think it would be useful for the committee to address it, the liability is within the scope of IFRS 16. Mm. I think that is quite important. Is that what you're saying?
No.
I think she was basically saying the same question.
Question arises.
Okay, comes up for anything.
Even if it's a plain vanilla simple lease with, you know, 100 per annum.
Fine. So the point was going to be slightly different then, before I had misunderstood that, which was following on from something Karsten had said, which I think is actually relevant to the day one accounting, because if this is in IFRS 9, for example, then that would tell you exactly how the liability is measured, because it has to be at fair value. So you might get another missing part to your double entries. potentially. So or I guess what I'm saying is you might have less choice about how you measure the right of use asset, because it might
on an ongoing basis
towards what even the day one right of use asset is, if you financial liability is what the measurement of that has to be.
But let me just test something with you to see whether. So say that I had my journal entry, so I'd done initially paragraph 40 entry, so I've ended up with a credit of 450,000 for my financial liability, which gives us the gain, which I think we're saying is consistent with the 100A calculation in IFRS 16. If I then concluded, and it's an if for anybody listening, not yes, I've concluded. If I concluded that it was in the scope of IFRS 9, and I went to IFRS 9 and it says you have to recognise everything on day one at fair value, and let's say for argument's sake the fair value of that liability was something slightly different to 450,000, I think I'd still say that was an adjustment entry to the carrying amount of the liability on initial recognition in 9, as opposed to adjusting my gain of 600,000, which I've been required to do by 16. Would you agree with that? I wouldn't, because I think what the paper's saying, which is that the gain calculation is clearly articulated as getting you to 600 in this fact pattern. Mm. If I then concluded that actually the financial liability, as we've called it here, is belonging in the scope of 9, you'd have to go to 9 and say, OK, now what do I need to do with that financial liability, and I might need to adjust to get it on the IFRS 9 path.
But that would not adjust the gain, and it would not adjust the measurement of the asset, because that IFRS 16 tells you what to do there, and if you adjusted those, you would no longer comply with 16.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying, I think I agree with you, Sue, is that the agenda decision says there are different ways you could use to calculate the initial carrying amount of the asset.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If you recognise the liability at fair value, which would be using the same journal entries as that, so there is the 450, you know, that kind of implicitly implies a method you've used to calculate the carrying amount of the asset. So it would be rather odd to me to use a completely different method to carry the asset and then have liability at fair value and then have this adjustment that you made to the liability.
I think as long as that fair value was consistent with this logic that's required to be applied to basing the entries on the sort of carrying amount of the asset, maybe yes, but I'm not sure it would always be the case. That's my only hesitation.
It should be close, because that will represent kind of the value of the right of use of the
TIA.
Lisa?
I was going to say I agree with the staff paper and how you would actually calculate the gain on the sale leaseback, but the question I had was the same thing when I went to the calculation. I was trying to figure out how did we calculate the financial liability, and it took me a little while to realise that, okay, this relates to the financing element. Mm-hmm. So I do think maybe it is, that's where I had a question of, on the financial liability, where do you classify it? It's not so much there is a portion related to the lease, it's just, is the whole thing a lease liability, or is there a portion that you put as a financing that goes into IFRS 9 and a portion that's the lease liability? And that's the bit that's unclear. But I still go a little bit back to the point of the day one. If let's just say we have a financial liability in IFRS 9 and you put on the books at fair value, if you have someone that has a different, I mean, I guess the whole bit is that you're assuming in the fact pattern here that everything is at market. So when you calculated the numbers that you determined what your actual gain on sale was, that was at the same fair value that you would put the liability on the books at if it was an IFRS 9. But if there was any views of a difference there, that the expectation that maybe one counterparty has one expectation that is what's going to be paid versus what's going to be received on the variable element, there could be, it might not be symmetrical in how the two different parties, how they would look at booking the entries. Does that make sense?
I think my only hesitation here is, and the reason why I think Bruce is saying that the journal helps a lot is, as I understand and read 16, it's driving these entries off the values of the assets, so the carrying amounts and the sort of fair values of the assets and the right of use asset. And as a consequence, the financial liability amount sort of falls out of that calculation. So it's an indirect measurement of the liability rather than a direct measurement of the liability, which is why I think you might get some level of disconnect between a direct measurement of the financial liability at fair value and what falls out of this journal entry. Okay. And I think that's what 16 is telling you to do, at least to calculate the gain.
You gain this way. Yeah.
Carsten?
Just to add one aspect to the discussion, if it was in IFRS 9, I know we're still debating it, but if it was, I don't think you necessarily would measure it initially at fair value, because obviously you have the guidance in IFRS 9 on day one gains and losses. If the transaction price deviates from the fair value, at least something I think that needs to be, you know, one should think about when analyzing the matter. Right, because the guidance tells you if you don't have an observable market, you adjust your fair value to the difference between the transaction price and the fair value. And I think that's something to think about when analysing.
I agree, but I think that's, again, separate to this gain.
Yes, it is, yeah. Yes, I agree.
Ron?
On the point about what if the transaction as a whole wasn't at fair value, I think in that scenario you'd have to make an extra adjustment.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I mean,
maybe that's the
date. Before doing these journals, or in addition to doing this journal, you would have an additional one to adjust to put things at fair value. And interestingly, if you had above market terms, then the next paragraph of IFRS 16, being paragraph 101, tells you that above market terms would specifically be accounted for as an additional financing, which is kind of may or may not be a clue as to what you do with this credit. Assuming it's at fair value, I guess going back to something Mary said, it seems like there are two models, aren't there? Either you acquire the right of use asset in exchange for accepting the lease liability, in which case you start by calculating the lease liability and build up, or your right of use asset is something you retain because you had the underlying asset to start with, in which case you start with the right of use asset and sort of work out what the liability has to be. I tend to think the liability is kind of within the scope of IFRS 9 because it is an obligation to give to deliver cash, but it's within the measurement, at least initially, it's within the measurement scope of 16 because 16 is, and in our discussion, I think maybe it's helpful just to acknowledge that all lease liabilities are financial instruments.
Yes.
In a sense, it's just that they're within the measurement scope of 16. And the discussion here, I think, is that 16, as lots of people have said, isn't specific at all about what the subsequent measurement of this liability is. So I guess the question becomes, is that silence kind of okay? Because people are quite intelligent and can maybe come up with acceptable accounting policies without having to have them in an agenda decision, or does it specifically have to be in the agenda decision in the interests of kind of completeness?
Okay. So I think Russell has very nicely drawn out the fact that we were asked a very specific question within the context of something that's a little more complicated when you look at the full analysis, and the staff paper is focused on answering that very specific question, and the tentative agenda decision also focuses on that very specific question, personally acknowledging that there are other questions closely related to it. So I guess what I'm going to do is, in the first instance, see whether, in the context of the question we're asked, so how we calculate this gain or loss on the sale and leaseback transaction in accordance with 16, do you agree that we shouldn't add the matter to the standard setting agenda, and whether, and if that's the case, whether you would be, could support a tentative agenda decision which includes some words about the fact that the liability represents the obligations in relation to the lease back, so give that aspect of colour but not more specifics beyond that. And so, you know, if we don't get support for that, my suggestion would be that we ask the staff to go away and look in a little bit more detail at what the sort of liability aspects are, rather than voting on that on the fly, because I think it's too dangerous based on just oral chat. But Bob, do you want to?
Yeah, I want to raise a point that I made before, because I think it's really pertinent to this question. It's not about the liability. It's about the question that's being asked and how specific do we want to get. So I'm going to read the question that was been raised at page 21 of 25 by the submitter, but I'm going to insert my words. So it's when the lease payments relating to the lease back are, and I'm inserting, not recognized in the lease liability, now going back, of which totally variable and not based on an index or rate are a subset of that, how is the proportion of the previous carrying amount of the asset relates to the right of use retained by the lease lessee determined? So I think that this total variable not based on an index or rate is just a subset of really what the real issue that they're asking is. And the payments that are in that set, besides a variable not based on an index or rate, would be renewal options that are not reasonably certain.
So that is a different fact pattern. I think that if you as a committee decide you want us to look wider than question asked, because maybe I'm not understanding,
if we answer only this fact pattern, we are answering only a subset of the same question. Because if I've got a renewal option and I don't recognize that in the lease liability, how do I deal with that in how was the proportion of the previous carrying amount divided?
Yeah, so I view that as a different question, because I thought this one was highlighting how do I do it in the context of there being variable payments. I'm not saying we can't do it. If you as a committee want us to go off and analyze that, we can.
The question is, how do I divide? That is the question.
How do I divide?
Yeah.
And the variable payments is only a subset of that question. And I'm saying I think we should be dealing with the whole question, just a subset.
So you think it would be more helpful if the agenda decision was making the point, in elegant wording, that when you've got a sale and leaseback transaction, there's this very specific regime in 16 that tells you how to calculate the gain or loss on sale. And yes, that's true. That's basically what the agenda decision is saying. Mm-hmm. So all of the normal rules and thinking about how you measure the lease liability go out the window because there's a very specific regime.
It's very specific.
Yeah. Mary, do you want to follow up?
If I could, because it just builds on what Bob was saying. I think there maybe if the question in the agenda decision were phrased slightly different, maybe not as explicitly as Bob said, but the submission raised the question of whether the requirements in IFRS 16 for measurement of a lease liability affect the measurement of the right of use or the gain or loss on disposal in a sale and leaseback transaction, as discussed in paragraph 100A. Because that is really the question that they ask is, do the requirements for measurement of the liability, which in the fact pattern they submitted, is entirely variable, and so, therefore wouldn't be recognized. Do the requirements in IFRS 16 for measurement of the liability affect the application of paragraph 100A for measurement of the right of use or the gain or loss on the sale and leaseback transaction, to which I think the staff analysis respond, and everybody here agreed, is no, that you have to apply paragraph 100A for calculating the right of use and the gain or loss. Despite the requirements in IFRS 16 for measurement of the lease liability, that doesn't answer the question of the nature of the financial liability.
I feel in my heart that I might want to agree with you, but I'm also nervous about doing that on the fly, because I think what I've certainly focused on personally when I've been looking at this paper is the fact that there's no real questions about lease term per se, but there's questions about which payments get included in the measurement, and it's this whole, turnover-based rental that's being highlighted. I feel like I should be able to say yes, but because I haven't analysed it, I'm not confident I am asking for a vote on an agenda decision based on that. And just in case the lease term thinking is slightly different for some reason.
I agree, and that's why I asked for this to not be finalised today, but bring it back to us, have the staff do more research on the whole set rather than issue an agenda decision, a tentative agenda decision on a subset.
sounds like a bigger project, but yep, in theory. So, and Guy?
I originally put my card up because I wasn't clear on the wording suggestion you made. Is that wording suggestion going to be clear that the liability is in scope of IFRS 16? Was that the intention of that?
No. It was intended to be neutral in describing what it is.
So what I was going to ask you to vote on, first of all, is whether the committee agrees that standard setting is not required to answer the specific question that has come in, which is the gain or loss journal entry, essentially, and to publish an agenda decision that reflects that, with the one change being to make an observation about the fact that the liability represents the obligations under the leaseback or something along those lines, but only to say that on the liability side, to see if there's support for that. If there isn't support for that, then I would be asking the committee to confirm that that means that you want the staff to go away and do some more analysis about what the liability is, or at least what scope of which standard it would be in, and we'd do some extra analysis and bring it back and to consider putting that in, whether standard setting's needed in an agenda decision with an additional step of analysis. So basically I'm saying, are you happy to go out with an agenda decision that's answering just the very specific question asked, or would you actually rather we do a little bit more work on the sort of day two point? So with... Oh, Lisa.
No, I'm just... I was just going to say, one last thing. I mean, could we possibly add into the tentative decision that also that it doesn't address the day two accounting, just to clarify that the day two accounting is not addressed in this decision. So then, if people have questions about what do you do with the liability, then that would make it clear that we're not stating how you would account for that liability subsequently.
That would be okay. As a suggestion for people to vote. So with that. So, a show of hands on whether the committee agrees with the recommendation not to add a matter to its standard setting agenda to address the day one journal.
So, which ones are some confused? Just the agenda
question
decision?
Two, yes, the agenda decision. Do you agree that we don't need to do standard setting? And then if you say yes to that, then I'll ask for a vote on the agenda decision.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. As a precursor to that question.
Right. Then we'll wait.
11.
Okay. So based on that, then, does that mean that... Can I get a show of hands on whether you would agree with the tentative agenda decision with the clarification about the comment about the liability representing the obligations under the leaseback and confirming, per Lisa's suggestion, that this agenda decision is not addressing the accounting for that financial liability? Show of hands for the agenda decision? Be brave, put your hands up straight. One, two.
Off you three.
Okay. Only three. So I'm sorry, staff, some more work. So
we love it, spending more time
so in our just to confirm, the work will be on whether what the analysis is of what we think the certainly the home for the accounting for that
liability
based on the requirements in the current literature, I won't say the name of the standard, and anything we can say based on what's in those requirements about how that might work, and then go from there.
And are we basing it on this fact pattern, or are we?
I'm concerned about adding more fact patterns.
Let's focus on this one.
I think if we just focus on this one, we're going to get the comments on the renewals.
I think if we focus just on a very narrow fact pattern,
Bob, you're going to write a letter to us.
But if people have concerns on other fact patterns, they will ask a question, and they will submit a question. If they don't submit a question, then there is no issue.
Let's see how confident we are about saying... I think if we could say something explicit in terms of that this means that when you're looking at the measurement of the liability, that this, in a sense, trumps the requirements on how you usually measure the lease liability, how confident are we to say something in that direction? I think maybe that's the way to look at it. Okay, so with that, I think we've earned a break. So... We're running behind time, so if it's okay, could we reconvene the slightly under an hour. Could we reconvene at, say, 20 to 2? Would that be okay? 50 minutes?